welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm back at Shakespeare's Globe, I'm delighted to say, with Nick Bagnall, who last year was the director of the Harry the Sixth plays, and he got to do three plays in a lot of different places, didn't he? And this year we're here to talk about another play about war, one play, The Last Days of Troy by Simon Armitage. So welcome to Theatre Voice again.
Thank you very much, Judy. Lovely to be back. Thank you.
So, but there's a theme emerging. First of all, isn't there war, which we're going to talk about a lot, but this time you get a living author, not a dead one.
Yeah.
And I presume that brings good and bad.
Only good on this occasion, actually. The relationship with Simon is very solid. I've known him a long, long time, actually. I did his first ever play in, when was it, about 1996, as an actor. And he wrote a play called House, which was for a site-specific space in a 16th-century workers' cottage in Huddersfield. That was when I fell in love with his work, and from that time I then started to kind of investigate a little more about him. And of course, he's a truly incredible writer. I then, as an actor, did a play called Mr. Heracles at the West Yorkshire Playhouse, where I played Madness in it. Literally.
Yes, I'm sort of smiling at this. It gives you a taste.
Which was an interesting experience. It wasn't one of the most brilliant times for both of us, but we became quite close over that job. And then this came up about 18 months ago. I mean, I think before I... Actually, the last time I spoke to you, Judy, I think we were already kind of in the process of developing it from the Iliad, obviously, The Last Days of Troy. So, it's been an incredibly exciting and really educational working with somebody who is really at the top of his game when it comes to words. And I think he's started to really enjoy... In fact, I know he has. He's really started to enjoy theatre. Which is great, because he says it himself, theatre, it's kind of, it's hard for a poet, because he has such a totalitarian line in his own work. He's the kind of boss of everything. So to then have me telling him what I think, and also him telling me what he thinks, it's been quite a learning curve for both of us, actually, because I'm used to working with dead writers, like you say, and they don't really have an opinion anymore, unfortunately. Their estates do. But, it's been incredible, and I've learnt so much, and we've got lots of things going on even still. We're going to do something else here again, which is really nice, in the indoor theatre in the autumn, which will be lovely.
That's good news. What's that one?
We're going to adapt... Well, he's adapting it at the moment. It was a poem of his called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and he did an amazing translation of it. In fact, the most accessible one. It's wonderful. So we're going to do that with some actors in the little space in the autumn, in November at some point. So things have been really exciting with Simon, and I think he feels the same.
Well, I'm sure he does, and the programme notes are fantastic. The sort of your path through various pubs, I think, and cafes.
Yeah, it's true. I've been kind of involved with it, which is great for me. I mean, it's such a treat. But I've been involved with it since it's, I think, as Simon says, since its abstract beginnings, actually, which was just us meeting. And, he'd already got the commission to do the Iliad at the Royal Exchange, which obviously this is in association with the Globe, The Last Days of Troy. And once that commission happened, luckily for me, he suggested me. So then we started to workshop the play, which was incredible because it went through so many different worlds, actually. And as you know, the Iliad is a sprawling mass of a poem, and there's so many contradictions in it, and there's so little, there's not much to hook onto as a narrative, actually. I mean, they're 10 years in a stalemate. So Homer's kind of delivered this incredible epic poem, which Simon, I think, has made the most accessible version of it. One of the major things that I did with him was make sure that it had a kind of theatricality about it and a clear narrative, and this idea that in the Iliad we follow so many people, that it was really important to me and to Simon eventually that we absolutely were really clear about who we were following. Whether we were following Achilles or Agamemnon in the Greek camp, or whether we were following Paris, Hector, Andromache, Helen, it was really important that we kept that very clear narrative. And also, we wanted it to be fun and have lightness in it. I mean, again, one of the big things I was involved in was just making sure that the title wasn't the Iliad. Because I know that if I see the Iliad by Homer on a theatre poster, I know I'm in for a long night and I'm not so sure it's my bag. So just making that decision to actually change the title to The Last Days of Troy, which is all Simon's, was Simon's idea, it was his title, I just think it opened it up a little more. Plus, incredible casting again.
Well, you certainly assembled a cast. It's hard to imagine other people playing the roles. They embody them so well. Yeah. And everybody obviously is going on about Lily Cole playing Helen. Yeah. But, and I thought a lovely quote, one of the critics said, there was the face that launched 1,000 products.
Yeah,
but
well,
it's not... The other thing you could say about her, she's not just a pretty face.
Oh, she's one of the most intelligent, funny, rounded girls I've ever met. And I didn't offer her Helen of Troy. She auditioned for it. I mean, I'll just very briefly talk about what happened, actually. I was sat in Moulton, where I was living at the time, in a little market town in Yorkshire, and I was having a beer with a friend of mine. And I was thinking about how to cast Helen of Troy. I mean, how do you cast Helen of Troy? You know, of course, yes, she's the most beautiful woman since the beginning of time. I don't know how to cast that. It felt like it needed something otherworldly. And what Lily... So anyway, we had this conversation and all of a sudden Lily Cole's name came up and that was it. I went, right, we have to know if this is possible because of what she brings to the arena, you know. And also she's studied the classics. She's not stupid. She took herself back to university at the age of 18. And, you know, after a huge career in modelling since 14, she took herself back to university and studied the classics, which obviously involved a lot of Homer. So I approached her agent and it was wonderful because usually when you approach big names like that, and of course she's an incredibly big name, when you approach big names like that, agents automatically go, it has to be an offer, which is understandable because there's offers on the table left all the time. But with her, it was brilliant because she knew Simon Armitage's work. So we sent her the play. She was out in LA and she loved it, fell in love with it. This was a very late draft, actually, quite one of the last drafts we did. And she said she'd fly over and meet me in Manchester. So she did. And I kind of fell in love with her instantly, actually, just instantly, because she was so generous and so warm. And then the thing that nailed it for me was I still hadn't offered it, but we went up to a room and there was some scripts lying around and she wasn't going to read for me. And then all of a sudden I just said, do you mind having a read of the scene? And she just went, yeah, why not? And I thought, oh, God, right, okay, she's got bravery as well. Mm. So then we offered her it, and she bit our hand off, and I couldn't be... I mean, I don't know who else could play that part. Of course, there's incredibly beautiful, incredibly talented actresses all over the planet, but there's something else that she brings into the place. So, yeah, I think it was quite inspired, actually. And I think she's had an amazing time and she's learnt a lot. And the fact that she's only ever been on stage to do, I think, one night at the Old Vic with the 24-hour plays, you know, all of a sudden she's in a room with me and 11 heavyweight theatre actors. She's a real challenger. She challenges things, but all in the right way. So, yeah, fingers crossed, you know, there's a future with her somewhere as well. I hope that she continues theatre because I think she's certainly got it. You know, she can do it.
Simon Armitage has written a particularly intelligent part for Helen. Yeah. And I think that's what shines through. It's there in the writing. And as you say, you could sort of guess she was a classicist,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And yet she is this statuesque beauty in this wonderful white dress, so she looks different from everybody else. Yeah. But poor old Helen, you know, everything I've ever read about the Trojan War, and I have to say, I was a classicist myself earlier on, and so fixated on Greece and Rome, but particularly the Trojan War. You've got to be sorry for this woman because she's always this fish out of water. She's always in trouble. She's never really... We don't quite know who she loves. But in this version, Andromache has sort of got it in for her.
She has.
And you can see why, because Andromache's entire future is at risk.
Absolutely.
More than we
absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely.
Anyone who knows the story knows it's going to happen. And,
yeah.
And so, but what is so intelligent is the sparring between them is quite incredible.
Oh, I mean,
the
good.
Fabulous lines in it.
Good.
Andromache says, when men see you, they smell sex. When women see you, they smell death. And Helen just turns it on his head. So beautifully.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is this incredible writing of a poet who writes prose like poetry.
Absolutely, and can combine the domestic and the epic in a sentence, you know, literally. It is a very intelligent reading of Helen of Troy and a very intelligent writing. And considering that she really doesn't really appear in the Iliad, not really. You know, she's got, I think she's mentioned in one chapter, considering that this whole war is about her, It's quite incredible what he's done. It was a major, big decision on Simon and Mai's part to make sure that she had a voice. It's also a fascinating thing that Simon's done, in the sense is that she never gives anything away because she doesn't know who's going to win the war. And she doesn't know who wins the war until the final beat of the play, which is then she'll go home. That's been the toughest journey, actually, with the characters, how we've developed them. Working the Andromache Helen line through the plays, through workshops, through development, through different drafts. And now what's happened is I think we've found a very... It feels incredibly clear that Andromache, like you say, she has to have it in for Helen. I mean, Helen is going to be the downfall of a whole civilization, actually. Yet, I think what Simon's done so brilliantly is that he's not ignored, and neither have I hope. I've not ignored the fact that, unfortunately, our 2014 views of women don't sit in that world, and that's hard, because they are treasure and they're pieces of meat, and that's really important that we didn't lose that.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about contemporary relevance in this play, both to 1914 and the 100th commemoration of the beginning of the First World War. Yeah. But also, you mentioned Syria in the programme, and it's the first thing you think of, actually, you know, and other conflicts. And women are still being used with that. What, 200 women missing in Nigeria and counting? What are they except the spoils of war?
Exactly.
They're being they're objectified worse than this.
Right? Absolutely.
And rape is now a weapon.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what happens to there's a young concubine, Briseis, in the play that Agamemnon demands of Achilles? Achilles is clearly in love with her.
I think Briseis is, you know, really, she's one of the most extraordinary creatures in the play, because she doesn't have a voice at all, and she does. She's pushed from pillar to post, and she's raped en route.
Raped en route.
You know, that is, and I think. That's a relationship. The Achilles-Briseis relationship is something that actually... Achilles did love Briseis, and yet Agamemnon and the apology from Agamemnon, he needs that apology from Agamemnon in order to move on. And I think that women don't... I feel very strongly with... That's why we put her in the burqa. And it felt, you know, a very political statement. Mm. And I hope that that's the case, because, yeah, she's covered from head to toe. And... like you've just said, I mean, that's happening now and now and now. I mean, I think, the statistics are there's been about 26 seconds of peace, hasn't there, in the last sort of 300 years. And you just think, I know that's probably an exaggeration, but...
not as many as that.
Exactly. So, I'm glad that has that contemporary resonance, but we didn't want to bash everybody's head with it at all. And I think that's what I made a very bold decision with the design, that it had elements of contemporary life, but it all came, the image for the design from me came from a young lad in the Congo who was on the front of, I think it was the metro, and it just hit me instantly, and he was there in a Nike t-shirt with Adidas tracksuit bottoms on, sandals, and carrying an enormous rocket launcher. And if there isn't a better image of the West infiltrating the East than that, I don't know what it is. And from that, everything seemed to spark. And I think that what was really important to me and Simon was that we told this epic poem in an epic way, but it needed to have contemporary resonance, but we couldn't avoid that. You can't avoid it because of what you've just said. There's also a part of me that was really, it was really, really important that it's a domestic play which has epic overtones. I mean, completely. I mean, but the reality is these boys... or men, have been on that beach for 10 years. So there's a kind of political backroom squabbling going on in the first act, which is something we developed. So it meant that once Patroclus goes into battle, we then see the fate of Achilles. Because in the Iliad, as you know, we don't see Achilles' death. I think it finishes at Hector's burial. So we then had to find a way of going, well, that's a boring ending to a play, actually, just in purely... theatrical terms, it's boring not to finish the story, like to try and get them home, whoever goes home. So that was a big decision that we then had to look into the Virgil, the Aeneid, which was, there's a great chapter in it with the Virgil, which is, I think it's chapter 2, which gives you a kind of streamlined version of everything that happens at Troy. And then it has that incredible character, Sinon, in it, who's the first liar, which is just wonderful.
Yes, he's the one who manages to fool the Trojans into thinking that the horse is a wonderful offering that must be dragged into Troy at all costs.
Yeah.
And I remember the name when I saw it in the programme, and I was so looking forward to that bit, and you didn't disappoint.
No, good, good. And obviously Brendan O'Hare, who I've worked with, as you know, last year on the Henrys, he's got such a grasp of language that you give that man those words and that with that muscularity in this particular space, and it's magic when it happens down there, Sinon. But that was, you know, it was important that we finished the story somehow. And the next thing that Simon and I are desperate to do is to sail them home. I mean, we're desperate to do the Odyssey next.
I suppose you need to, don't you?
We do. It feels really important, actually. It's certainly important for Simon as a writer because, you know, he's done these great adaptations of these great epic tales, but actually he's done a radio version of the Odyssey, which is wonderful, incredibly witty and incredibly kind of, you know, wild at times.
I've heard it, actually.
Yeah. So we're in the process of getting that together now. It'd be nice to take our Odysseus as well with us on that journey.
I want to talk about some of the casting. We didn't name check Andromache. She's fantastic.
Claire Calbraith, yeah, terrific, and also doubles up as Thetis, which is...
Yeah, it's a lovely pairing,
it's a nice doubling, that, isn't it?
Yeah, because she's sort of powerless as Andromache and actually rather powerful as Achilles' mum, divine mum, Thetis.
Yeah, absolutely. No, she's been incredible. They're, without fail, all of them, including the kids that I've got in the company. And I have to say that in Manchester I had 30 Trojan army boys that they became known as the ensemble, and down here there's 15 guys. I can't name check them all, I wish I could, but they're all from Mountview Theatre School, and I have to tell you, they've walked in and I had 3 hours with them to re-block, redo major massive moments in the play that involve them, which is, you know, really precise storytelling, and they've nailed it.
Well, it's a fabulous experience for them, but yes, great for you to be able to draw on that resource.
Yeah, absolutely. So without those, that was a big thing to actually, when we talk about how the play, how we navigate ourselves through this epic story, because that was a major decision, was that I needed 12 protagonists that I didn't want to do what I did with the Henrys last year, which was have, you know, somebody doubling as Menelaus, I didn't want that. I wanted very much to go, I want to concentrate on these creatures fully.
Well, actually, you dispense with Menelaus altogether, which is quite clever, because he's sort of, you're not quite sure it's all happening because of him, and who is he sexy? No, he probably isn't, because he's a cackle. What will it be like for you to go home? We just don't know.
Well, I tried to fight the corners to get Menelaus back in about a year ago, and I'm so wrong, and I'm so happy to be wrong. Simon talks about it brilliantly, saying that he wants his brother to do his squabbling for him, which I think is great, because then that final beat at the end of the play where Agamemnon turns around to Helen and says, well, I thought your husband would be, I thought my brother would be here to collect you and take, but actually he's too busy storing the jewels in the boat. And you just go, that's the futility of it. That's gone on. Hundreds and thousands of men have died, and women, and families have been erased. And you just go, that's the reality of it. And I think it's got a crueler edge without Menelaus. Mm. And I like that. And who knows what happens when they get home? I mean, we do know, we've kind of been told, but you just think in my version, in Simon's version, it's still so ambiguous what happens to Helen.
You have these different layers, I suppose we could call them, where we have, the play opens with Zeus, the god, but he isn't, is he? He's sort of been reduced to selling statues of himself and actually posing as one of those those still statues.
The gold statues you see in Covent Garden,
Dodgiest beard I've ever seen, and even more dodgy Thunderbolt.
Absolutely. Again, he's, before we even cast Richard Bremer, who is a genius and can play an audience in the palm of his hand like I've never known, and he's playing Zeus. Zeus went through an enormous amount of rewrites. He was originally Jon Snow, the news reporter, and we were going to use video.
Glad you didn't do that.
Absolutely. And it went through all these in workshop stages and all that, and then we started talking, Simon and I, and the question was, one of us asked it, and I think I asked him, I just said, what happens if nobody talks about the gods? And he went, well, they don't exist. And that's where this whole thing about Zeus came from, which is a true story. When you go to the archaeological site of where they believe Troy to be, there are stalls with trinkets of Zeus and Achilles and Agamemnon and Helen, and it's kind of, it felt very honest that they're in limbo, they're stuck. And from that, it then was a major decision to start concentrating on a kind of refugee. And I think once you got Richard Bremer and Gillian Bevan, who plays Hera, involved, who are our contemporary gods as well as our classic gods, they invested in this refugee thing beyond belief. And it turned into a very sad, it turned into very poignant and very rich. And it got very sad in rehearsals when you think about, you know, refugees and this sense of what's home, and they've been there for eternity.
And will be.
And will be there for eternity. And I think it's, and also just on a very theatrical thing, which is probably where my work starts, is, again, it comes back to the title of the Iliad. I didn't want to go into Olympus in the first scene. I didn't want that. I didn't want my gods dressed in suits. I didn't want togas, you know, and it's just a question of taste with me. But one thing I was absolutely adamant about, which Simon's gone and nailed in that first speech with Zeus on the statue, is I want the audience to feel like they can laugh.
Oh, it's very funny.
Because then you've got, you know, it unfolds for you then. I mean, we all know there's going to be blood and guts. We all know that there's going to be savagery and brutality, you know, the mutilation of Hector and all those. We all know that's going to happen. Even if there's just a tiny bit of our brain, we go, oh, the Iliad, isn't that Achilles, da da da. We know there's going to be blood and guts. But we don't know what happens when we walk into the globe and all we see is a suitcase and a man stood on it dressed as a statue of Zeus. All of a sudden, there's a lightness involved, which allows me then to play with that. But yeah, I mean, that's, I have to tell you that the investment in those contemporary gods from those two actors, I mean, it's, I can't imagine anybody else playing them, really.
Well, that's nice, because you're saying that a lot, and I'm liking that as an idea that these people have made these parts their own.
Yeah.
So there we have these other layers. Well, obviously, the most obvious one, really, is that the other layer of gods, when the gods, back in the day, when they are powerful, and when they, just as we imagine them on Mount Olympus, you know, quaffing nectar of the gods, and I love the fact that Zeus has got this sort of enormous, he's either like a weather forecast that he's directing thunderbolts here and floods there and so forth, or it's almost like back to the First World War. It's almost reminded me a bit of in Blackadder, when you see the mad generals pushing platoons around on a chart.
Yeah.
It was a bit like that. So slightly taking away the responsibility for men for their destinies, because now we're supposed to believe that it's all down to the gods.
Absolutely. I think there was a big decision on Simon's part, which was, and he talks about this to this day when we're talking about the Odyssey, is that, you know, the gods are more normal than the humans, and they haven't got much to do. And I think what we have found in this production is there's a lot of fun with those gods and a lot of mischief, and it's at times, and it's probably the wrong phrase, but at times it's a little bit like a Carry On film with those gods on Mount Olympus.
It really is.
You know, and we kind of embrace that. And then,
it's wonderful that Hera is, you know, she's famously jealous, with good reason, because Zeus is always turning into other creatures in order to rape various women. And I think there's a reference there. Thetis is probably one of his conquests.
I'm not actually sure.
We don't know, do we? But Hera's jealous because it's another woman asking for something.
Absolutely.
And you play that up brilliantly.
Yeah. But one thing that was important, thinking about the difference between being a poet and a dramatist, which now he's absolutely nailed, is that it was really important that, yes, there's that fun and that lightness on Mount Olympus, but by the time we get into Act Two, the horrors of war that they've created, they have to witness that. Mm. So I've made that big, bold decision I made, which I think works beautifully here, where the final scene of the gods, you know, Paris is dead in front of them. And it's just, there needs to be a reminder. So that was really important, that they had an arc, that it wasn't just about being Barbara Windsor in a Carry On film, but it was actually that eventually we do see that they have to be affected by this.
So now let's go to our other layers, which is the layers you would expect, which is the Greeks on the seashore, stranded, as you said, and the Trojans in their beautiful city, terrified, really, you know, trying to get on with their luxurious life.
Yep.
But, And that's very interesting too, because the first thing you do, we meet the Greeks first.
Yeah.
What I liked there was that, apart from the fighting, the terrible infighting between the different leaders, is it felt like the trenches in the First World War. They've been entrenched for 10 years.
Good.
And there's pestilence raging, and God knows what. That comes over so strongly. There's a lot of really good Simon Armitage speeches in prose.
Yeah, absolutely.
About this total futility, what do we always call it, the horror and the pity and the futility of war. It's all there, isn't it?
Absolutely. Just kind of in very brief terms, I made a very conscious decision at the beginning of the rehearsals to keep the Greeks and the Trojans and the gods separate.
And that shows, and it's good.
Yeah, I think it needed it, because as you say, you know, there's three different worlds collide. We've talked about the gods, but you know, the Greeks are absolutely living in a plague-ridden beach. That's where they're living. And day after day, thousands of men that they've brought over are dying of disease and a plague. All because of Agamemnon's arrogance, which is a huge story, but it's about arrogance and pride. Mm. What's happening in the Trojan citadel is, absolutely, they've got this wall where they're able to protect themselves, and they've also, which I learned with research, which is another story, research to this play, but underground they had tunnels where they had food and water, so they had supplies that they were able to keep alive. That was the thing. What Priam is brilliant in, which is why we kept them separate, is that there is a glittering Troy in our production.
Yeah.
But it's decaying. It's decaying more and more. So I think by separating those worlds and just, you know, you know what I'm like, and I love the nitty-gritty and the kind of filth and rawness of, you know, theatre. And I think that we had a really good chance to explore both of those worlds in Troy. It was interesting when they collided, like when we had to see certain scenes in rehearsal. Of course, it wasn't about a company being separated. It was just I'd do a couple of hours on the Greek camp and then a couple of hours on the Trojan camp and then a couple of hours on the gods. And then eventually we had to start mingling it in. But I think there's so many contradictions in the research for this poem, this Homer poem. There's so many contradictions. There's so many different versions of events when it comes to Helen, when it comes to Achilles, Agamemnon, Priam. There's so many different versions. And, you know, you can pull a book up and it'll tell you one thing, and then the next bit of research will tell you another. So I made a massive, bold decision that I was not going to have any research in the room after a certain point. All I have to have is those words. And what happened then was that was when all of a sudden we started to go, okay, this works by separating the worlds, because it's not 12 voices in a room, it's four voices and me in a room, which meant that we could invest in Simon's play a lot more than going, oh, what does Homer say in the Iliad, what's that? And it's relentless, it can just become, and I think what Simon is so wonderful at, his turn of phrase when he came to rehearsal for a day or two, he went, I've been to the library, you lot don't have to. And I just thought, that's so, you know.
Oh, very, very true.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, the year before, of course, I had to fill my boots with everything the Iliad, everything Helen. That was really important to do that. But you can get bogged down in it, and it can become an intellectual exercise. And actually, this is guttural and nasty and brutal and human.
As far as the words are concerned, I think there's another quote from you about the actors loving the taste of the words on their lips. And of course, that comes over to the audience. I mean, it's often to do with Helen and Andromache for me. And that's another layer, the women's scenes.
Yeah.
You know, the female domestic is different.
Yeah.
And it's a very different vibe. So in Troy, there's really the two layers. And again, they come together, they clash, you know.
Because
when you know, obviously the husbands come onto the scene, and you actually have Astyanax, Andromache's little son, who I think is between the worlds.
That's right.
So just for a moment, so it's good to see him.
I think it's really important. And also, you know, what was really important in Andromache's journey through the play is that she has a duty to fulfil. And I think in the Iliad, it's quite difficult to get that from Andromache, because what we get in Simon's version is we get the scene with Astyanax and Andromache as Hector is going out to battle, which we believe will be the last time he ever sees that family. I think Simon's invested in that journey quite a lot, and it feels really important that, because that's about family, and that's not about this great war that happened 3,000 years ago, or was talked about 3,000 years ago. That's about now, and, you know, that knock on the door, and you know, the green army uniform behind the door, and you just know. And that was one of the hardest scenes to do. And that went through a lot of rewrites in rehearsal as well, because it felt like we were overindulging in it. And then we both just went, we're not, it's that important. She's not going to see that man again. And the whole of this civilization, this civilized world that Priam has set up, and it was a huge civilization, and it was cultured, and it was all those things, you know, by Hector going out into battle with Achilles, that's then done. It's the end of that world. And yeah, he's dealt with that brilliantly, and that's hard to find that voice of a woman in the Iliad, actually.
Well, finding it, he certainly has here. Again, it's that first scene. I think Andromache says, when you're around, there's always a cemetery in the background.
Yeah.
It's also funny, but it's telling.
Yeah, it's horrible, absolutely. Yeah. The cemetery in the background. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then he goes on to, there's a description of her being white-faced, white, you know.
Yeah,
so,
white-faced,
you know, all,
behind a white veil, yeah.
There's a lot of stuff about white, so she's this enigma, and it's cold, and it's scary, and that sort of thing. And then there's this wonderful scene, that's just a poem, really, it's Achilles invoking his mum and saying, if you're lucky enough to be the child of a god, it's like you've really lucked out. You know, you're sort of, you can just say, mum, my foot, come and help me. And but there's this beautiful image of a pomegranate tree. You're lucky enough to be under a pomegranate tree where you're always going to have shade and
absolutely,
food.
Absolutely, yeah.
And he's saying, I'm not going to go for that. I'm not going to exploit that. But it's things like that. I don't know. You know, that's where you can see the poet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who would think of the pomegranate tree but a wonderful poet?
No.
The idea that that's where you get your sustenance from. And
absolutely.
That's like, that is your divine mother.
That's his skill.
Gorgeous.
It's absolutely beautiful. I have to tell you, when we did the first preview in Manchester, I cut 40 minutes of the play.
Not that.
After. Yeah, we did. And because it was really important, because as you know, it's hard, you know, until you start seeing the arc of the production or even the arc of the play, it's hard to know that it was too long. It felt too long. And that was one thing that I was very adamant about, that it wasn't going to be a 5.5-hour epic. So after first preview, Simon and I got together and both of us said, look, we need to make cuts. I mean, this was hard to do this, to actually say to him, we need to get rid of quite a lot of the poetry. What was amazing about Simon was he asked the question, why? And I just said, because it doesn't move us forward as a story. We don't move forward. But the one thing that we kept was that a man born under a pomegranate tree, which is the only piece of verse actually left. And it's the only time that an actor is in the space on his own, apart from when we're in contemporary Zeus world. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the responses to Manchester and London, he's got this line in it, in which is his favourite line, which is, they're from the north, they'll eat anything. And it's hilarious, the difference. In Manchester, there's the biggest kind of round of, oh, that's just so hilarious. But here, it's really quite funny. It's like all the Londoners go, yeah, exactly. And it's like, how dare you? But there's those little things that he's found. That is genius.
There's another layer as well, isn't there, which is generational. So you've got Priam played by...
Gary Cooper.
Played by Gary Cooper. Fantastic. Again, so touching, you know, having to go and plead for his son's body from
that particular section has got to be one of the most incredibly emotionally draining things when, you know, those four lines, again, which is written in verse, it goes, I go to my knees and lift to my lips the hand of a man who killed my son. And then there's this silence, which Simon doesn't actually write very much pause or silence. He doesn't believe in them, you know, we'll find them. But what happened here is there's a silence and then it's repeated. And it's kind of gut-wrenchingly horrible. That's incredible stuff.
Yeah, brought tears to my eyes, actually.
Oh, good. And it does to a lot of people. Yeah. It does.
Which brings us neatly to, we've been talking about audience response. You're saying it must have looked a bit different in Manchester, the play, and obviously the playing start, at the Globe, you are appealing to the groundlings and so forth, which they do. And you've perhaps got more people who are saying, oh, I'm going to go to the Globe, don't care what it is, but this is my, you know, and they're tourists and so forth. So there must be different audiences and it must be slightly differently staged.
It's completely different. It couldn't be more different. What was fantastic about both spaces is that they've both got an element of intimacy about them, which sounds odd when you think about the globe being so huge and kind of daylight, but there is a real intimacy about those groundlings. And at the Royal Exchange, you can't escape the stage. It's just, you know, you're in the round. But we made a decision quite early on, me and the designer, Ashley Martin Davis, who's just incredible, and how he's created. Because I did another play alongside Troy as well, which was about war, a play called Britannia Waves the Rules by Gareth Farr, which we're doing again, actually, at the Exchange. Which was
love the title.
Yeah, and it's an incredible play about a young man. It's, you know, who goes to Afghanistan, so it has real resonance with now. So those two plays sat really beautifully side by side, but the design then had to fit both plays. So we decided to get rid of it being in the round at the Exchange by putting the Trojan Gates in, which meant that we then kind of knew that we would be able to transfer to the globe easier. Not saying it was easy, but a lot easier if we weren't going from the round into a, you know, where we are here in this public arena. What was so exciting about the Royal Exchange was the fact that I got a chance to flex my muscles, which I always like doing, with light, sound, and a most extraordinary creative team. You know, and it was just a wonderful experience to direct in a theatre that I've wanted to direct in for many, many years. And I like the immediacy of all that. And I like the fact that at the Royal Exchange, I was able to keep the menace in the room by having the army around it and things like that. When we got down here, which is always the case down here, because it's always so busy and it's always so kind of full on when you get here to bring something in, is that you don't get much time in the space. So I spent a lot of time in the final week in Manchester with a ground plan in front of me and just calling the groups together again, going back to a rehearsal situation and going, look, so can anybody see any problems with themselves by the time we get there on Sunday to get it in? This is where I see it moving, da 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 da. We got down here and we started to speak this play, and then all of a sudden you just go, this is where this play belongs, because it's, you can't hide anything here. I think that it worked perfectly in both spaces, but on a personal preference, I prefer it at the Globe, because it's about actors and words. And of course, I had to do quite a lot of reblocking and quite a lot of restaging, but I love doing that down here, because I feel my confidence is up in those things, actually, since doing the Henrys last year, about how to stage huge battles and huge kind of, you know, huge stories. And I think that by it was a great experience to take those Henrys around the country and then bring it into the Globe. I felt like it served me well for this. But they're hugely different plays. I mean, I've had to change so much. And even on the first day down here, I got the actors together on the next day to give notes, and they were quite a serious, firm note session, because what happens at the Globe is, if you're not careful, as an actor, you become very comfortable, and it becomes a little easy. And I think was always my note, which is, you've got to remember you're at war, because it is really hard down here, because it's magical. And you walk into that space and you've got 500 groundlings looking at you and absolutely adoring this magic and this kind of sacred space that we're in. But actors feel that, and they can, it can move them into an area which is a bit fussy and a bit weak. And it was really important. So the next day I had quite a fierce speech about it, which was really, it was really important that we still, our intentions and our kind of, you know, our story and our intentions and the given circumstances have to be the same. They actually have to be intensified down here, otherwise the magic will overtake you. And I've seen stuff down here, including my own stuff last year, where I've watched a production at one of the Henrys and gone, it's worryingly slow, or it's worryingly easy.
They're just enjoying it too much.
Exactly, and that's hard. It's a hard note to give an actor, that, because you want them to enjoy themselves. But
you said somewhere along the way that everybody knows the story, particularly down here. I wonder whether they do. I think they will have no problem accessing it.
No.
And what would you think? I mean, if you and I are talking as people who have been brought up with it, but
yeah.
Not everybody has.
Well, also, I wasn't as well. I mean, I pretended to read the Iliad years ago, and I mean it. You know, I kind of, at drama school, I read the Odyssey, which I really enjoyed. And I think, you know, I can't remember, it was just after drama school, I pretended to read the Iliad because I thought that was the right thing to do. And I kind of skim read it and kind of thought, yeah, all right, I like all the battles. That's really interesting. But then I grew up a bit. So when it came up again, I had to read it, obviously, and Simon put me onto an extraordinary translation of it. And I couldn't put it down. And it is one of the greatest stories ever told, in everything, for so many reasons. So I didn't really know it. But what I think I meant earlier is that we all know that there's so many phrases, isn't there, in, you know, the Achilles heel. Mm. You know, so somebody somewhere has... something will happen in the back of their head when they mention the character Achilles. Mm. Helen of Troy exists as we speak. That's wherever. You know, even people like Agamemnon somewhere, there's a kind of, you know, I don't know. My mum came to see it, and my mum's never read the Iliad. She's a highly intelligent woman, but she's never read the Iliad. It was funny because we were talking in the bar after at the Royal Exchange, and she was just going, it's really interesting that I know so many of the little stories that have come up. And I think that's what I meant. But yeah, I mean, I what's amazing about this dramatisation of it, Simon's dramatisation, is that it's accessible. It's so accessible. Again, coming back to what we first started with, that was a major decision that we needed to get rid of all this sprawling mass of narrative and be clear about who we're following. He's done that. I mean, he's done that. My job has been to make sure that that narrative is clear in a staging sense, in storytelling terms, I suppose.
Nick Bagnall, thank you so much for talking to me for Theatre Voice.
It's always a pleasure, Judy. Thank you very much.